You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, businesses are looking at different ways to package their employee benefits, in part to appeal to younger workers. But new research shows that millennial women lag behind their peers in actually using time off. First, the usual take on the recall elections in Wisconsin in 2012 is that they were a bust. Governor Walker kept his seat and then notched another victory. And in the Senate, Democrats earned a small majority for a short period of time, thanks to the recall, but they lost that edge in the next election. Our guest reports that even though the recalls didn't yield much for Wisconsin Democrats, though, that time was instrumental for evidence gathering in what is now the Wisconsin gerrymandering case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Matthew DeFore joins us now. He's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matthew, great to talk with you again.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
So take us back to the recall elections of 2011 and 2012. Who was up against those recalls and what were the results?
Sure. Well, there were 13 Senate recall elections over 2011-2012. If you remember, of course, there was a lot of opposition among Democrats to the governor's proposal to basically scale back public sector collective bargaining, which became 2011 Act 10. And the Democrats, gathered lots of signatures to recall not just the governor, but there were 13 recall elections. Some of those were triggered actually by Republicans who were upset that the Democrats, some of the Democrats, or all 14 of the Senate Democrats, fled the state. And when all the dust settled, the Democrats had the majority, a one-vote majority, for 5 months.
And that 5 months was looked at as not very significant, or, you know, was it really worth it? But you say that during those 5 months, what was accomplished might have been a bigger deal than it seemed at the time. Why is that?
So we've obviously heard a lot about this redistricting case that's now before the U.S. Supreme Court. And what I come across was an interesting story that connected the dots between that recall election victory for the Democrats in 2012 and some key evidence in this redistricting case now before the U.S. Supreme Court. It turned out that the Democrats, when they had the majority, were able to compel the law firm that was representing the legislature during the redrawing of the maps in 2011, Michael Best and Friedrich, they were able to compel them to turn over the entire case file that was part of an earlier redistricting case called Baldus versus Brennan. And in that case, they had gone through a lot of struggles to get documents in the discovery process. This was a Madison attorney, Doug Poland, and a Milwaukee attorney, Peter Earle, were the main lawyers, and they were trying to get records from this law firm. And it was the Democrats who were able to basically get them to turn over the records once they became the majority.
So it sounds like, just to make sure I'm understanding this, when the Democrats were not in power, they had no power to be able to compel release of these documents. Once they were in the majority, they had that standing to do so.
Right, and that was reported at the time. What was new in this story, it was pointing out what happened after that, which is, and again, some of this has been reported, but some of it had not. And what was new here was that what they did is they took that to the judge. They found 34 documents that were not included in the original discovery. They took that to the judge and they said, we want them to release the entire hard drives from the computers that were used to draw these new maps. And so they got those hard drives. They ended up finding hundreds of thousands of deleted documents, and you know that basically pushed them into a case where they settled with the attorneys for Michael Best and Friedrich. That was all reported. But flash forward 2 years, and where the story picks up in my piece that was in the State Journal on Sunday, is that they ended up using those hard drives in this new redistricting case, Gill versus Whitford. And so when they were coming up with a standard to prove partisan redistricting, they came up with a test that has three different prongs, one of which is showing that there was a partisan intent on the part of the Republican lawmakers who were drawing these maps. And in order to show that, they found all kinds of evidence on these hard drives. And so when they went back to the hard drives They found some pretty key information that helped them prove that the partisan intent prong of their argument.
And Matt, let me ask about that, because you said that there were many, many hundreds of thousands of documents, I think you said, that had been deleted.
Right.
Were they able to recover any of those through forensic investigation?
Right. So what happened was in the Baldus versus Brennan case, they had a forensic investigator, a former Secret Service investigator named Mark Lanterman, who's based in Minneapolis, and he was allowed to do some preliminary investigation of these hard drives, and he was able to find that hundreds of thousands of files had been deleted. Now, during the Baldus versus Brennan case, that's pretty much as far as they went. It cost, I think, about $100,000 for them to even get that far with the evidence. And so they had a list of the files, but they didn't really get the details. They didn't recreate them or pull them off the hard drives. They did that a few years later as part of this Whitford case that's now before the U.S. Supreme Court.
And you talked about the need to establish intent on the part of Republicans. Are you talking about actually their intent in the redistricting that they wanted to put into place, or is it intent as in they deleted these files and that points to intent to hide evidence?
No, the significance of the deleted files is that it gave them, they came back later and were able to reconstruct some of them. And when they did that, they could show that with every iteration of the redistricting, every iteration of the lines that were being drawn by these Republican staffers who were doing it basically secretive conditions at the offices of Michael Best and Friedrich, they were trying to make the maps more and more Republican. So at one point they had a map that, you know, let me start from the beginning. They, when they originally looked at the existing maps that were in place during the 2000s, they determined through analysis of the voting patterns that the Democrats would have a 50-49 majority in the 2012 elections. So when they redrew the maps, they were able to shift the lines around and basically make them so that the Republicans would hold a 54-45 vote majority. They further, massage the lines even more as using, again, these computer programs that can draw them very compact and very specifically to try to come up with basically the outcome they're looking for. They had them up to a point where they were expecting that the Republicans could win 59 seats, again to the Democrats 40 in the 2012 election. And so when they were able to uncover all these spreadsheets, including one that had this heading, the tail of the tape, which is a boxing reference, they were able to present that evidence to the court to say, see, look how much they were able to, they were specifically changing these lines for a partisan purpose. They were doing it to win the election for partisan reasons, and that's why we think the lines should be thrown out as unconstitutional.
And do we know how far back those Republican redistricting efforts, plans, projections, when did they start working on those?
Well, this is a decennial process. It happens every 10 years, and it's the majority party in control of the legislature and the governor's office that does it. But, again, we haven't had one-party control of the redistricting process since 1951. This was the first time in 60 years. And so with, there's certainly evidence that they were able to uncover in their earlier trial, where they found Republican staffers saying that this was a once-in-a-generation opportunity to draw the line, the maps that Republicans had always wanted, and so they got to work on it, fairly soon in 2011, sort of while all the Act 10, demonstrations were going on. This was sort of starting to get into the works.
And Matt, briefly, as we wrap up, the Supreme Court is looking at Gill versus Whitford. This evidence is key for that argument. Would this case be where it is without the Democratic majority for those 5 months in 2012?
The lawyers for the Democrats certainly think their case is much stronger because of this. Is it the reason why it got to the U.S. Supreme Court? I don't think anyone can say for sure, but it certainly makes their case stronger.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew DeFoor covers politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about how the short time that Democrats held the state Senate after recall elections was crucial for gathering evidence in the gerrymandering case that is currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. Coming up, we'll look at why young female workers are the least likely to use their paid time off and what would need to change in order to fix that. Stay with us here on Central Time. Americans as a whole tend to not take all of the vacation time that they've earned, and that's on top of earning fewer days than workers in many other countries. On top of that, younger workers are even more hesitant to take time off, and young women take less than their male peers. Jenna McGregor writes a daily column looking at leadership issues in the news for the Washington Post's On Leadership section. Jenna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of vacation time does the average American get?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. We're one of the few places in the world where there is not any kind of mandate over what people actually get. But there was a survey done a couple of months ago from an initiative called the Americans, called Project Time Off, that found that on average, what people use, the amount that they use, is about 16.8 days a year.
So a little over 3 weeks.
Exactly.
And is that just vacation time, or is that also sick time?
You know, the way this was asked about vacation time, but you asked a good question. A lot of companies have shifted to something they call paid time off, where they bucket vacation and sick time together. But the question was asked here, in terms of vacation use.
And let's talk about that repackaging of benefits like time off and making, you know, maybe a big pool of just possible time that you can take, whether it's, you know, you're sick yourself, you're taking care of a child or a parent, or you're taking a vacation. Why are some businesses repackaging benefit time like that?
Well, you know, there's a couple of reasons. I mean, one is just that it's simpler. I think it allows people to use it for different reasons. You know, you can just decide why it is you need. But, you know, the companies also, there's been this push toward this idea of unlimited vacation time, where you can say, oh, you know, you can take as much time as you want. And it kind of comes up with the paid time off idea, too, which is that companies have to carry a liability on their books mm-hmm. 1 year to the next if they have people carrying over vacation time. And so if you limit it into a bucket of paid sick time, of paid time off, or if you say, oh, there's no set amount, then it's a little easier for them to not have to carry so much over on their books. So it sounds really great, but there's a benefit to the company, too.
Well, and I want to talk about how that works or whether that works, but I also want to ask, generally, big changes like that don't happen without a reason. So I'm wondering, who are those companies hoping to appeal to with changes like that? Who are they hoping to hire and retain with those tweaks to how benefit time is structured?
Well, you've seen a lot of that happen in the limited time off idea in smaller tech companies, although there have been, some that have followed suit. But they're really trying to go after, I think, a younger demographic with those benefits because it's interesting. This same survey showed that millennial workers are most likely to kind of see themselves as, quote, work martyrs. They use the least amount of their vacation time. And that is for several reasons. But, I think it's a perk that they hope will attract younger workers.
And I have to say, we're talking about an age group, but for the most part, we're also talking about people at a certain part of their career. So if they're younger, they're probably at an earlier stage of their career. Do you think that is part of the reason that they're feeling that they have to martyr themselves to make a good impression or to ensure that that they rise to the top out of their peer group?
Well, this is a group of employees that came into the workforce with huge amounts of student loans, with a really weak job market, many of them. At the same time, so there's those kind of fears and uncertainties that they face. At the same time, they are younger. They don't have as many responsibilities outside the home, and therefore maybe you're able to do outside of the office, and therefore maybe able to work a little more than some other demographics do. And so I think the combination of those two things, have really created a group of employees who work pretty hard despite the reputation that sometimes follows.
We're talking with Jenna McGregor. She writes a daily column analyzing leadership in the news for the Washington Post's On Leadership section. And we're talking about a couple new surveys that show that young women especially are lagging behind their peers and taking time off that they've earned. And actually, let's dig into that, Jenna. We talked about millennials as a whole being less likely to take the time that they've earned or that is available to them, depending on how it's structured in their workplace. But those surveys also showed that young women, millennial women in particular, are the least likely to take the time off they've earned. What do you think is going on there?
Well, the reasons that they said was that they felt more guilty than their male peers in taking the time off, that they are worried about the mountain of work they have to do when they return, that they feel replaceable and want to show, quote, complete dedication. And so I think the feeling of guilt or martyrdom has affected them more than their male peers at that group. Interestingly, though, they were more likely to talk about the importance of taking vacation and taking time off than their male peers. Their behavior just didn't follow it.
Hmm. One of the things in thinking about your article and this topic was certainly some of the gendered nature of different jobs has decreased in the last few decades, but there's certainly still some areas of employment that tend to be more male-dominated or more female-dominated. And I think about female-dominated ones as often being caring professions, so nursing or teaching. I wonder if that, too, makes those women less likely to take their vacation because they feel like people are counting on them in a very real and concrete way.
You bring up a great point. I think it's certainly possible that wasn't something that showed up in this data. Likewise, I think young women are just that much more aware, particularly these days, of the pay gap that continues to exist, of the perilous road to the top that they sometimes face, the discrimination that continues to exist, and it's certainly in certain work, in certain industries, and they feel they just have to work that much harder to show that they're committed.
There are also a lot of interesting reasons why when that vacation time and sick time, basically all of your earned time is lumped together into one pool, that people might tend to take less of it than they might if it was kind of segregated out. What are some of those reasons that came up in research?
I completely agree, and particularly since we also live in a country where there is no mandated paid sick time or requirement for certain kinds of parental leave, that people hold back and say, I'm worried that I'm going to have a sick day and I can't take all my vacation. I'm worried that my child is going to get sick and I'm not going to have any days left over, and so they hold back on taking the vacation that they that's part of that bigger bucket of what they get.
You said as we started our conversation, Jenna, that on average Americans take 16.8 days of vacation time a year. Do we know how that compares to how much time they are actually eligible for?
I believe that the latest numbers were about 20 days, somewhere in that range. So I think it's just it really varies a great deal from one employer to the next and from type of industry to the next to public and private sector employees.
And Jenna, as we wrap up, why is it in the interest of employers to encourage their staff members, their employees, to take time off?
Well, and this study pointed at that. It found that people are more productive or more likely to get promoted when they take time off. I think that there's a bit of common sense in there. But I do think employers, particularly large companies that have more progressive policies, have woken up to the fact that we have got to make sure our employees take time off. Some companies, particularly some interesting tech startups, have even started to pay people to take their vacation. You know, not only get vacation, but you get an additional bonus if you actually go on vacation. So I think companies are starting to wake up to the fact that this is, we have to have a semi-well-rested workforce. We have to have people who take breaks, who have time for their family, and hopefully that trend will continue too.
And finally, as we talked about the fact that millennials in general, especially millennial women, are more hesitant to take the time that they have, what kind of changes do you think would need to happen to turn that around and for them to feel, yeah, I've earned this time, it's good for me, it's good for the company, I'm going to take the week off?
I think the most important thing to send that message to anybody, but particularly to younger workers who may feel some insecurities about their position, is to see their manager take it. I mean, it's the most basic thing, but if you don't see your boss using the time and your boss leaving at a decent hour at night and your boss practicing what the company policy is, you're going to feel, you're going to feel reticent to do the same. I mean, policy can go a long way. Mandates can go a long way, maybe, but really, you know, the leadership of the person who you work for demonstrating that this is okay to do, I think it's the best way to get anybody to take it.
Jenna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jenna McGregor writes a daily column for the Washington Post's On Leadership section. It looks at leadership topics in the news. She joined us to talk about why millennial women take less vacation than older workers and less than their male millennial colleagues. And we want to know what you think. Does your employer provide different vacation and sick time, or is it one pool? How good are you at taking the time you've earned? Do you often leave time on the table at the end of the year, or do you make sure to take every day you have coming to you? And if you're a younger worker, do you feel pressured to be a work martyr and forgo taking time off? Would it make it easier, as Jenna said, if you saw your boss taking vacations and days off? Post your thoughts and see what others have to say over on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, we'll talk about the healthcare votes today in the U.S. Senate. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Experts say today is the last best chance for Senate Republicans to change the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. This afternoon, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell led a vote on the motion to proceed. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin cast a deciding yes vote to move forward with debate on the health care bill. Vice President Mike Pence voted to break a 50-50 tie in the Senate on the procedural vote. Two Republicans voted no to debate health care reform. They were Senator Susan Collins from Maine and Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. While Republicans had the votes to proceed today, it's unclear whether or not the votes will be there for passage of a bill. Capri Cafaro joins us now. She's executive in residence at American University's School of Public Affairs and a former Democratic leader of the Ohio State Senate. Capri, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Well, as we mentioned, some have called this the last best chance for Senate Republicans to change Obamacare. Would you agree with that assessment?
I would agree with it in the sense that, you know, had the motion to proceed fail, I think that the leadership, the Republican leadership in the Senate, would have essentially abandoned the repeal and replace or sole repeal agenda in favor of tax reform, because if they were unable to even get to the first initial step, basically to proceed on debate, there would be really little to no hope to go through the actual process of deliberating a bill. So, in that sense, I think that is, somewhat of an accurate assessment. But as you kind of alluded to in the introduction, we are a long way away from actual passage or implementation of, a dismantling of the Affordable Care Act.
And why would this be a last chance? We are about 6 months into the Trump presidency. Certainly, the Republican Party is going to be retaining control, as they have now for quite a while. Why would this be the last chance to do this?
Well, because, at this point, we've already seen, only in the first 6 months of this Congress and this new administration in the White House, that There's been a great deal of contention and hesitation surrounding, you know, what it means to repeal and replace, not just opposition from, you know, Democrats in both chambers, but dissension within the Republican caucuses in both chambers, because there is a difference of opinion on, you know, whether or not, for example, fixing the Affordable Care Act is really fulfilling a campaign promise. You know, versus, you know, a straight repeal and then replace. So you have the conservatives, like Rand Paul, for example, that want, you know, a much cleaner version, a straight repeal. And then you have, you know, some of the others that have, for example, voice concerns, like Sherry Moore Capito of West Virginia and Rob Portman of Ohio, that ultimately today did vote yes to proceed with debate, but may have some concerns. So, you know, the longer this goes on, the less likely it is for those differences to be rectified if they can't even get to the first step of engaging in, you know, the official debate.
And how would you rate the transparency of this process leading to this vote today? Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin told reporters last night that he wasn't even sure what senators would be voting on today.
Well, you know, I would certainly give it an F. You know, I think that there's been a lot of discussion. Again, they've been trying to figure out a way in Congress amongst the Republicans to fulfill this campaign promise of repeal and replace. And as such, there's been such a sense of urgency amongst the White House and Republican leadership to find any way to get the horse out of the barn, so to speak. And because of that urgency, and because there has been so many different ideas thrown around, different amendments having to do with everything from, you know, creating a slimmer plan on the exchange by Ted Cruz to, you know, providing additional dollars for high-risk pools or for the opioid epidemic to try to assuage, you know, some of the more moderate members. There's been so much out there that, you know, and there's been no consensus around any of it. So, you know, you have this perfect storm of so many, you know, concepts flying around, no regular order as far as going through the committee process, doing hearings and amendments and markups, and just trying to find any way to force this thing through. So in my view, and in my experience as you know, 10 years as a state senator in Ohio, that's not what the American people want or deserve. You know, it's about trying to actually go through the legislative process and, you know, and working in a bipartisan manner to actually create a stronger policy product.
We're looking at action in the U.S. Senate today on health care reform bills with Capri Cafaro. She's executive in residence at American University's School of Public Affairs and is a former Democratic leader of the Ohio State Senate. And Senator John McCain from Arizona came back to the floor today, his first day back after his brain cancer diagnosis. And here's what he had to say about after the vote to proceed with debate.
We've been spinning our wheels on too many important issues because we keep trying to find a way to win without help from across the aisle. That's an approach that's been employed by both sides, mandating legislation from the top down without any support from the other side, with all the parliamentary maneuvers that requires. We're getting nothing done, my friends. We're getting nothing done.
Some harsh words there from Senator John McCain for members of his own party. What do you make of his assessment?
Well, he's absolutely right in his assessment of how things have gone. I mean, you can level the exact same charges, you know, pretty much against the Democrats in 2010 as they, you know, barreled forward with the Affordable Care Act. You know, Nancy Pelosi famously saying that, you know, we had to pass the bill to know what was in the bill. You know, to the point actually where Charlie Wilson, then a congressman from Ohio, actually was pulled out of the hospital at George Washington Medical Center to go vote because he had an appendectomy, and then Sherrod Brown from Ohio actually was flown back on Air Force One from his mother's funeral. So, you know, John McCain coming back, you know, and trying to move this ball forward is nothing new to, you know, sort of the process of trying to move things, but. No question that things have been at a grinding halt because there has not been any cooperation from either side, and both parties are guilty of, when they are in, you know, in the position of power, to just trying to move their agenda forward without actually going through the legislative process and seeking consensus.
We're talking with Capri Cafaro from American University now about today's vote on health care in the U.S. Senate. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you think the Republican Party should move forward with health care reform? What do you think about the House bill that was passed in May? And what about the different versions of the Senate bill that have emerged? How might health care reform affect you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up our discussion now about today's healthcare vote in the U.S. Senate with Capri Cafaro from American University. You can join the conversation too at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see the U.S. Senate repeal Obamacare? How would a repeal affect you? And what do you want to see happen with health care reform in the U.S.? What do you think about how Republicans have handled health care reform so far? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time on WPR. Now, Capri, what's the strategy of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell here in voting to proceed with debate?
I think that what he did was, you know, set a self-imposed deadline basically try to put everybody on record to determine either one of two things. One, show that there is enough support to proceed, or two, say we tried and we couldn't even get this, you know, across the starting line. And so now we've tried this in multiple machinations. Let's move on to a different topic like tax reform so we can get some kind of a legislative victory. Remember, we are almost in August, and the 2018 elections are quick approaching. So, at some point, the House and the Senate need to show that, you know, particularly on the Republican side, that it is possible for them to have legislative victories because they control both chambers of Congress and the White House right now. So that would be my assumption. I certainly can't read Leader McConnell's mind, but that would be, my thought on why he was making that choice today.
Well, and I want to go back to something that you said, Capri, because you said a self-imposed deadline. But is it really, or is this coming straight from President Trump?
President Trump has been, not even really consistent on saying, okay, we need to do this. Then he said, no, just let it fail. Then he said, no, we need to do this. We need to stay instead of leaving for the legislative recess. So, I personally think that this was more of an issue on the side of the Senate trying to at least say, this was a mechanism to move forward, to progress on something. Whether or not that something was going to be the Affordable Care Act repeal and replace, or if it was going to say, obviously we can't do this right now and we're going to move to something else, this was an impetus to move forward. Now, let me just say this, though. Even though this motion to proceed was passed, I think it's important for the listeners to remember that this is a 50-50 vote. Two members of two Republicans and two independents voted with the Democrats. It was 50-50, yay versus nay. And Vice President Pence came in and cast the tie-breaking vote. So by no means is there, some level of consensus on, going forward with this legislation. There was just barely enough to say, yes, let's engage in a debate. So I don't anticipate that this road is going to get any easier, but it has opened a door to actually having it come to fruition. And there was a lot on the line.
Let's go to our callers now, and Jim in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, so I just wanted to comment on something that the Ohio legislator said about this being effectively some kind of fair play, because it's the same way, arguably, that the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010 without support from Republicans. It is absolutely fair to say that it was passed without support, although I would note that a bipartisan majority, which included Republicans, voted on a similar motion like this one today to proceed to a vote. Then none of them voted in favor of the actual legislation. But it's not fair to say that it's the same in total. There were committee hearings, there were public comment periods, there were markups. And in fact, famously, and in fact, kind of outlandishly to some people who would have liked to have seen the president do more of a steamroll, he held public meetings that were televised on C-SPAN where he brought Republican leaders to the White House and sat down with them for hours and said, what would you need to see in this bill to get more people health care? And they gave their ideas, and more than 100 of their amendments were accepted. And nothing happened, you know, in terms of them actually providing a vote. But it's not fair to say it's the same, because regular order has been thrown out completely here. To Senator McCain's point today, that this has been, the people who complained about the railroading of the Affordable Care Act are railroading on steroids.
All right. Thanks for that comment, Jim.
Frankly, Jim, that's all I was trying to say, that you know, the same people that are complaining about what happened in 2010 are, you know, subsequently doing, if not not the exact same thing, to, you know, mince words, but something very similar. And so, you know, it's the pot calling the kettle black, because we've heard for the last 7 years that, you know, this was done in some sort of unilateral way. And as you mentioned, you know, there were a number of Republican amendments accepted. And going forward, a number of Republican governors that chose to expand Medicaid. So it is not exact. And, you know, thank you for that clarification. But I was simply just trying to say that exactly how you said that this is the same, but on steroids.
Thanks for that call, Jim. And let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Nate in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Nate.
Hi. I kind of hope this repeal efforts fail, and I hope it fails basically for the good of a lot of people. And I'll point out that when Trump got elected, he promised better health care that was going to be cheaper and would cover everybody. This doesn't do that. So if they're saying now that they've got to do this to keep their promise, well, their promises and their word is already in the gutter in terms of what they've come up with thus far. So if the best is what we have already is Obamacare, then frankly, keep it and move on.
And so moving on, Nate, would mean keeping Obamacare as is, or trying to fix what flaws even Democrats say are in it?
I would support being willing to fix it, but going back to the idea of keeping promises and being trustworthy, they've been saying it's going to collapse, except the people looking at it are saying it's got problems, but it's not collapsing, so they're making that up as an excuse.
All right. Thanks for that comment, Nate. And Capri, you know, Nate seems to be saying that this should be their last chance, whether it is their last chance or not, and maybe it's just keep it in place and move on.
I think I am of the camp that we need to, make amendments to, the Affordable Care Act, try to address some of the shortcomings that do exist. The individual marketplace is different across the country. So to say that it is going to collapse under its own weight is really a gross generalization and inaccurate in many ways. Same thing with premium increases. For the listeners, to put me in context with healthcare, I've spent over 15 years of my career in some way, shape, or form working in health policy and co-authored Medicaid reform for Ohio, and I'm a licensed social worker. So I would love to get into the weeds of all of this stuff in a policy context. I know we're having a little bit more of a high-level political discussion, but one thing that I will say to respond to Nate about keeping the promises, Donald Trump's campaign promises are actually different than congressional Republicans' campaign promises. Congressional Republicans did promise repeal and replace. Trump said, we're going to give everybody better health care, and we're not going to touch Medicare and Medicaid. Those two things don't necessarily work together, and that is part of the challenge that they are facing right now in this, you know, debate over the future of the Affordable Care Act.
And I do want to get back to our callers in just a minute. But so, Capri, I think part of the confusion is there was this vote to proceed today. It was a procedural vote. But what are they proceeding to? Is it clear what bill might actually be voted on and when and how?
At this point, and I haven't seen the specificity. There are a number of procedural steps that go forward from here, and including 20 hours of floor debate, I believe, acceptance of amendments on the floor. But to your point, you know, and then they have to go back and do conference committee with the House. But to your point, what that is, I am not 100% sure what, the motion to proceed was on at this point. And I, you know, it's unclear to me, at least, which bill, if they specified at all, was proceeded on today. But I'm sure we will get to the bottom of that hopefully soon.
And I think it's really interesting, going back to something you just said, Capri, that, you know, this, all of this has just been to get a bill that might possibly be passed by the Senate. But the House passed their bill back in May, and assuming
that... And it took two times to get that done.
Right. And assuming that the Senate is not going to say, you know, let's just vote, let's make it easy on everybody, let's just vote on the House bill, that's very unlikely to happen. So they're still going to have to be, they're going to have to come to agreement between those two different bills.
That's correct. And I can tell you, conference committee is never pretty, because, you know, the both chambers differ. And, the House members, represent a small portion of a state, and the senators have to represent, you know, the collective entirety of a population of a state, which, you know, sometimes makes things, you know, a little bit more balanced on the Senate side, and the House a little bit more, factionalized. So this is not going to be an easy process. And, you know, there's no guarantees of number one, what policy gets passed, number two, when it gets passed, and number three, if it does get passed, when it gets implemented. The Affordable Care Act passed in 2010. The first exchange didn't go online until, you know, open enrollment didn't start until the end of 2013. Didn't go online, I believe, until like 2014. So there's a lot. We are a long way away from feeling the effects of what's happening right now. In the meantime, there's a lot of uncertainty in the insurance market, amongst patients, amongst providers, and amongst states that have no idea what's going to happen.
Well, and that's a really interesting point. That's a good place to kind of end on, is there's been so much uncertainty and so much indecision and so much conflict over health care in the House, in the Senate, in the nation. How would you say that all that uncertainty is affecting citizens and also the provision of health care?
I think that there's a great deal of apprehension amongst patients, not knowing, you know, what is going to be covered, particularly those with pre-existing conditions that some of the older population that have the most to lose if there is a significant change for any of the bills that have been passed. Providers, certainly, you know, they have received reimbursements in a way that they had not prior to the Affordable Care Act, so indigent care may go up. That could impact their workforce. That could impact, their willingness to take new patients. And then the insurance companies, you know, they said, for example, that the Ted Cruz amendment to provide a slimmed down insurance package on the individual marketplace was an unworkable, idea. So, you know, they're in limbo, too, as an industry, not knowing what to expect and when they need to, what their next steps are as an industry. So there's a lot at play here. And then state.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Capri, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Capri Cafaro. She's executive in residence at American University School of Public Affairs, and she's a former Democratic leader of the Ohio State Senate. She joined us to talk about action in the U.S. Senate today regarding health care reform, what some analysts are saying is the last best chance for Republicans to change Obamacare.